I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society. We're very pleased to have Atlas Society Senior Scholar Richard Salzman with us today on the GOP's positive platform shift on abortion. And after Richard's opening comments, we'll take questions from you. So please request to speak if you have a question. We'll try to get to as many of you as possible. Richard, thanks for doing this topic.
Thank you, Scott, and thanks, everyone, for joining me. I thought I would bring attention to what I think, as a lifelong Republican, is an important and positive development on the GOP's attitude toward abortion, and specifically as codified in the recent July 8th GOP platform. So what I thought I would, which is much more moderate and much more lenient toward abortion. But what I thought I would do tonight is go through fairly quickly the evolution of the GOP platform on just on this particular issue. And by the way, if anyone's interested in digging deep on this, there's something called the American Presidency Project. I think it's out of UC San Diego. If you go online and look for that website, they have an enormous amount of material on the presidency. But one of the great subsections they have is every major and minor, by the way, including Libertarian American Party platform ever produced. So it's a wonderful database on any issue, and searchable as well. So if you're just curious about the evolution of these parties, the evolution of their views on various issues, the Republican platforms go all the way back, of course, to the founding of the party in 1856. So I have used that, and that's one of the methods I've used for tracing the GOP's views on abortion. Now,
Richard, can you get just a hair closer to your mic, if possible?
Yeah, is this better?
Yes.
Okay. And now the other thing I want to stress is, and we can leave this to the end if you wish, but I have already in other spaces and clubhouses talked about the philosophic aspects of why women have a right to abortion, why embryos, fetuses, and zygotes are not persons. They're not human beings. They're not individuated individuals. Therefore, they don't have individual rights. We can go there if you wish at the end, but really my intent tonight was to be more focused on the particular position taken by the GOP on this issue. One of the reasons also I want to focus on it is not only has there been a positive shift, but I'm of the view that of the two parties, the thing most holding back the Republicans in terms of electoral success is exactly this issue. If anyone has watched the Democrat convention of recent days, especially last night, where their theme was freedom, it was, to me, almost incomprehensible that they could be parading around in every speech using the word freedom, 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 therefore freedom, therefore the freedom of the individual. I estimate that they used the word probably 10 times as much as the Republicans did, even though I consider the liberal, quote, liberal Democrats, some of the most illiberal people we see today. But they are right on abortion. They're not philosophically correct. They're very philosophically mixed about it. But the actual political position they have is for freedom of the woman to decide whether to abort a fetus or not. The Republicans are terrible on this. But on every issue other than that, the Democrats are against freedom. So I believe that if the Republican Party, and it does have opponents of the religious view of Nancy Mace would be one example, a rep from South Carolina. There is a very small part of the Republican Party that wants to be pro-choice. There are pro-choice Republicans. I'm one of them. And they just have not had much grip until Donald Trump, of all people. Donald Trump, who appointed three justices who eventually contributed to the Dobbs versus Jackson decision in 2022 by the Supreme Court, which overthrew Roe v. Wade, that was largely condemned as an anti-woman move. But in many cases, we could talk about this particulars in the Q&A as well, there are at least 7, 10, I count maybe even 12 states who, as a result of the Supreme Court throwing it back to the states, have more lenient and liberal and pro-rights oriented abortion treatments at local states than prior to Roe v. Wade. California being an obvious example, but you can imagine the others, New York and Minnesota and others. Now, of course, in the South, there are some that are more restrictive than the first trimester protection that Roe v. Wade gave. But I think the first group outnumbers enormously the second group. So in my review, this is a right. So there is absolutely no reason to leave it to Democratic vote at the state level. But on the other hand, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, sending it back to the states, has not been an unalloyed bad thing for women's rights. All right, having set the stage in that regard, and again, so on the specifics of this and what the states are doing, but also on the more philosophic aspects, if you want to talk about it in the Q&A, I'm glad to do it. There are wonderful essays by Ayn Rand about abortion and the right to abortion. There's an excellent 2013 Huffington Post, of all places, essay by Leonard Peikoff called Abortion Rights Are Pro-Life. At the Atlas Society, Will Thomas in 2011, if you look up Will Thomas and an essay on abortion, it was a Q&A, what is the objectivist view on abortion? How would one defend this view? That's another source to look at. And the last source I want to name before I dig into the platforms, Andy Bernstein's book, Capitalist Solutions, which I think is about 2009 or so, has a very good chapter, only 9, 8, 10 pages or so, on the philosophic and political aspects of defending a woman's right to an abortion. All right, so clearing the land, so to speak, that way, I thought I would do something that I'm not sure anyone has done, namely go into the weeds and go back and look at what the GOP has said in its platforms, in its official positions every 4 years on abortion. Now, I didn't go back all the way to 1856 because it wasn't even an issue. And I checked in 1972, and that's a year before Roe v. Wade, and of course there's no mention. When does it start getting mentioned? After Roe v. Wade, 1973. So now get this, 1976, this is not Reagan, this is Ford is the president, and he's going against Carter. Here's the only section mentioning abortion in the platform. Quote, because of our concern for family values, we affirm our beliefs in many elements that will make our country a more hospitable environment for family life. It goes on to say, educational systems that include and are responsive to parents' concerns, a welfare policy to encourage families to stay together, and, quote, well, that was a quote as well, quote, a position on abortion that values human life, unquote. I don't even know what that means. That's it. That's the only mention of abortion in the 1976 platform. Jerry Ford lost to Carter, as you know, in 76. Okay, now go to 1980. Who is it? It's Reagan versus Carter. Now, Reagan was widely criticized, broadly, repeatedly, I think in some cases actually unfairly, criticized by both Ayn Rand and Leonard Peikoff and others for bringing a religion into the Republican Party, but specifically bringing in the idea that abortion is murder, although we never did say that. Actually, when he was governor of California, Reagan had very liberal treatments of abortion, and Nancy was pro-choice. Not many people know that. Her doctor, father, Mr. Davis, was pro-choice as well and did abortions. Now, look at the platform, though, from 1980. I'll quote, and by the way, some of this later platforms will repeat, so I'll just say it repeats. Okay, so 1980, this is 7 years after Roe v. Wade, but the second platform I'm talking about after 76, quote, there can be no doubt, I'm quoting from the platform, that the question of abortion, despite the complex nature of its various issues, is ultimately concerned with equality of rights under the law. While we recognize differing views on this question among Americans and within our own party, we affirm our support of a constitutional amendment to restore protection of the right to life for unborn children. We also support congressional efforts to restrict the use of taxpayers' dollars for abortion, unquote. Right here, I want to indicate a phrase which comes up over and over and over again over the next 40 years, which is completely contradictory. But to its great credit, the GOP just dropped this language, and it's the language of unborn children. Now, philosophically and epistemologically and conceptually, that is a contradiction in terms. So just to say briefly before I return to the platforms, if you think to yourself and you know anything about the gestation process, think of zygote, embryo, fetus, newborn, baby, infant. Why did I just go through that sequence? The first three are in utero. The first three are not independent of the, I'm not even going to say mother, I'm going to say would-be mother. They're potential humans, they're not actual humans. The phrases we use for those who are born, baby, even we say newborn, baby, infant, child, adolescent, you simply cannot, and it's not just a semantical thing, by the way, it's metaphysically anchored. You cannot ever get away with using the phrase unborn children, because unborn is in utero and children are extra utero. It's equivalent to saying a fetus rides a bicycle. It is so absurd on its face. Leonard Peikoff actually once said, if you want to use the word unborn child, I get to use the word undead corpse. And therefore you can, you know, start vivisecting the corpse. It's a contradiction in terms. It's ridiculous. All right, now, 1984, it's still Reagan because he won the first election. This is 84. I think he's against Mondale. All right, so, but by the way, I want to throw in some historical interesting features. Who was his first Supreme Court nominee? Answer, Sandra Day O'Connor. Did he actually know her view on Roe v. Wade? I don't think he did. He either did or I don't know if he did or not, but guess what? She, in her time on the court, although wobbling at some point, upheld Roe v. Wade. Reagan very rarely got criticized for this. He certainly was not praised for it by objectivists for picking O'Connor. But O'Connor upheld Roe v. Wade two or three different times when it came up, when it was challenged. Another point I'll make, in 1987, he nominated Kennedy. Anthony Kennedy, this was after the Bork disaster. Kennedy was pro-choice. So O'Connor and Kennedy, two of the Reagan appointees, ended up being pro-choice, and the most important case being 1992, when it was challenged with Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Kennedy and O'Connor both upheld Roe v. Wade in those decisions. So on his actual Supreme Court nominations, and those weren't his only ones, he had more than those two, they were pro-choice. All right, the 1984 platform, quote, here's the language again, the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed. We therefore affirm our support for a human life amendment to the Constitution. That's new language. They want an amendment to the Constitution now. And quote, we endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to unborn children. Now, here's new language as well. We oppose the use of public revenues for abortion. And we will eliminate funding for organizations that advocate or support abortion. That would be things like Planned Parenthood. And then it has language saying, we commend efforts by individuals and groups to provide positive alternatives to abortion, like adoption and support for pregnant women. All right. What about... by the way, a little more on 1984. Well, I gave you some context there on 1984. That's enough. O'Connor and Kennedy by 1987. Okay, but now 1988 now, what does the platform say? Under the section, by the way, there are usual sections in the GOP platform about the family and the importance of the family, which are perfectly fine. They're perfectly good sections. But I find it's very interesting that they always put the abortion language under sections titled constitutional government or individual rights. They don't include it in the family section, which I think is quite interesting. But it's also more philosophically. I mean, I think it has to do with rights. All right, here's 1988's language. It pretty much repeats 1984's language. What's 1988, by the way? Bush won versus Dukakis. So Reagan is off stage by now. Quote, the unborn child has a fundamental individual right which cannot be infringed. We therefore reaffirm our support for a human life amendment. You see how the language is similar to 84. It's not much different than 84. But what's interesting is Reagan's off stage, so Bush 1 did not take the opportunity to change the abortion position. Whereas, as we'll see, Donald Trump did. 1992, what is the election? Bush versus Bill Clinton. Here's the section of the GOP platform. This is under the section called Individual Rights, Good Homes and Safe Streets. That's weird. Quote, this, we renew the historic Republican commitment to the rights of women. Dot, dot, dot. We believe the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed. Sounds similar? They're repeating it. We reaffirm our support for a human life amendment. Same language, but here's an addition. This is new in 1992. We affirm our support for the appointment of judges who respect their traditional family values and the sanctity of innocent human life. So here in 1992, Bush Sr. is pushing further to the idea that we should have a litmus test for the Supreme Court justices that a GOP president picks. Well, how interesting, because who did he end up picking? Souter. And Souter joined in 1992, in upholding Roe v. Wade. So George Bush, who in the platform of 92 said, we're going to appoint judges who question Roe v. Wade, actually appointed Souter. Was he from New Hampshire? I think it was from the Northeast, yeah. Who joined Kennedy and O'Connor, the Reagan appointees, to uphold Roe v. Wade in 1992. Interesting. All right, 1996. Bob Dole and Jack Kemp was the VP versus Clinton, who's the incumbent. What was the language there? It's the same old language. I'm not going to repeat it. It still uses unborn child. It still talks about the 14th Amendment. But here's what I think is very interesting, because this is partly a softening and partly a tightening. Quote, we oppose abortion, but our pro-life agenda does not include punitive action against women who have an abortion, unquote. Now think of that. Notice that how that has never been addressed so far. If, this has always been a problem in this position, if it's murder, why aren't we prosecuting the women who do it? Why aren't we punishing them? They always say, go after the doctor. But who's aiding and abetting it more than anyone? The woman. If the woman doesn't show up at the abortion clinic, there's no abortion. So in many ways, from their side, you could argue that the woman is more guilty. The would-be mother is more guilty than the doctor. But of course, they would never go there electorally, right? Philosophically, they're so mixed. They claim it's murder, but they won't put murderers in jail, like the woman. Anyway, they go out of their way because they were being pushed at this point. What are you going to do? Punish women? No, they say we're not going to punish women. But then, quote, this was happening in the mid-90s, partial birth abortions, for those of us old enough to remember. These were, quote, late-term abortions, not first trimester, not second, they were third. And by the way, true is today and true even then, it's only like 10%, maybe even less of the cases. But here's the section of the platform, quote, we oppose President Clinton's veto of the ban on partial birth abortions. A procedure denounced by the American Medical Association and rightly branded as 4/5 infanticide, unquote. Wow, that's in the platform. Now, infanticide is the killing of an infant, you understand, right? And an infant is extra utero. It's an infant is outside the womb. So there could be nothing crazier than the idea of a 4/5 infanticide. What they're really talking about is the pregnancy is 4/5 into it. Yeah, so it's late term. But that's not an infant. That's a fetus. Anyway, if it was truly infanticide, then that would be murder. You're killing an infant. But that's not actually what late term partial birth abortions were. But I just want to comment that what's happening here is, as the right to abortion becomes more and more established, and Roe v. Wade in 1973 is more and more in the rearview mirror, the Democrats are now, you could say, becoming more bold about, well, women can do it. If the women can do it, then they can do it right up until birth. And even the objectivist position, I think, properly is, although Ayn wobbles on this, she says it's most important in the first trimester, as does Dr. Peacock. In other words, they're echoing the Roe v. Wade stance. I would say human life begins at birth, not at conception. Then they should have a right to abort right until the end, so to speak, of the pregnancy. And that's what Republicans are now starting to worry about. So in the 1996 platform, so they've given up the idea of opposing abortion per se, and they're just trying to oppose this, quote, extreme version of it. Okay, now 2000, then I'm going to go faster after this. 2000, this is George W. Bush versus Gore, 2000. Quote, this is from the platform of 2000. The Supreme Court's recent decision prohibiting states from banning partial birth abortions, a procedure denounced by the AMA and rightly branded as 4/5 infanticide, shocks the conscience of the nation. As a country, we must keep our pledge to the first guarantee of the Declaration of Independence. That's why we say the unborn child has a fundamental right to blah, 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 blah. They just insert the same language that they had used previously. But here they're bringing in the current events of, wow, now the Supreme Court has recently, I think that would be 1999 or so, has said, now even partial birth abortion is okay. Now I'm going to do 2004, then I'm going to skip to 2016. But I found in reading these that the Bush W years were the most anti-abortion and religious language in the platforms. It was not the Reagan years. It certainly wasn't the Bob Dole years. But George W. Bush in 2000, 2004, and I assume these candidates had control over the language, it's really not only virulently anti-abortion, but it goes on and on forever. There's long passages in the platforms. Now, in the 2004, this is Bush versus John Kerry, uses the unborn language again. But now, by this time, the president had signed something called the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. I didn't even know about this until I read the platforms, which ensures that every infant born alive, including those who survive an abortion procedure, is considered a person under federal law, unquote. Now, I would consider that a person under federal law as well. So apparently there were cases where late-term abortions were tried. The infant came out of the womb. Well, the infant came in. They came out of the womb and became an infant. And then someone tried to kill it. That is infanticide. That should not be allowed. And then it says, quote, we praise congressional Republicans for banning partial birth abortions, unquote. I haven't had time to go look and see whether that was actually a law. Because if by partial birth abortion, they simply mean late term abortions, those are legal, but infanticide is not. All right, I'm going to fast forward now to 2016, because here's the shift that's happened. Then I'll take questions. I think I'm 23 minutes into this here. The language in 2016 is very interesting, because Donald Trump is obviously the nominee. And I don't think he spent much time and attention looking at this language, because it goes on forever. The longest language in any GOP platform on abortion occurs actually in 2016. I'll quote some of it. I mean, some of it's new. But some of it's old that I'll tell you about. But it's interesting, because they start shifting to the Declaration as a justification. Quote, the Constitution's guarantee This is the 14th Amendment, by the way. That no one can be deprived of life, liberty, and property deliberately echoes the Declaration of Independence's proclamation that all are endowed by their Creator with the inalienable right to life. Accordingly, that's the next line. Accordingly, we assert the sanctity of human life and affirm that the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed. And then blah, blah, blah. They repeat the language of prior platforms. Okay, here's what's interesting to me. The Declaration, of course, says, quote, all men are created equal. All men. Actually, individuated living men are created equal and have rights. It's so bizarre that in 2016, the GOP says the proclamation that all are endowed by the, not all, all what? Including all embryos? It's bizarre that they would invoke the Declaration for this, but that's what they tried to do. Now, the only new thing in 2016 I could find, and the shifts are very interesting. One, we affirm our obligation to assist rather than penalize women who get abortions, unquote. You get that? Previously, they had been condemned for saying, well, if it's murder, why don't you penalize the women? And their platform said, well, we oppose abortion, but we're not going to penalize women. You see the contradiction? What, are you letting murderers go away? At this point in 2016, they're actually saying, we affirm our obligation to assist, to help them rather than penalize them. Well, that sounds like aiding and abetting murder. You see how crazy and inconsistent the positions are becoming at this point. They're still using the language of unborn child, which I've said is contradictory. And now they're saying they're going to assist rather than penalize these would-be murderers. And the other thing which is also interesting in 2016 is, it, of course, it changes with the time and what the new controversies are, right? So now here it says, we not only oppose public funding of abortions, that's a repetition of many, many years, but then it says, and make it a crime to harvest. We want to make it a crime to harvest and sell fetal body parts. We oppose sex selection abortions. We oppose embryonic stem cell research. We want a ban on human cloning. I'm just taking out, this is the 2016. And then there's a whole section condemning the Democrats, which is new. It says, quote, Democrats are extreme on abortion. They give it almost limitless support. They even oppose abortion clinic safety regulations and support public funding. They have reduced the old Bill Clinton mantra that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And now it's just legal. We're proud to be a part of a party that protects human life and offers real solutions to women, unquote. All right, finally, here we are in 2024, I mean. So a month and 2 weeks ago, the GOP platform, and of course now we have the context of, as I said before, Dobbs versus Jackson, 2022, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, sending it back to the states, made possible by the three appointees of Trump. I'm not going to name who they are because I'll probably forget each name. Anyway, that everyone knows that his three appointees made that possible. But here's the language, and think how concentrated that is and how condensed and different the language is. This is all there is in the current GOP platform on this issue. Quote, we proudly stand for families and life. It doesn't say unborn child, does it? We believe the 14th Amendment guarantees, so it does mention the 14th Amendment again, that no person can be denied life or liberty without due process. Notice the word person, it's not unborn child, but the 14th Amendment already refers to persons. So philosophically, this is perfectly fine because a zygote, an embryo, and a fetus is not a person. And the 14th Amendment does use the word person. Quote, that there's more though. And here's the addition. And that states are free to pass laws protecting those rights. I'm still quoting now, after 51 years, this is referring to Roe v. Wade being overturned, because of us, Republicans, that power has been given to the states and to a vote of the people. The only other language is this: we will oppose late-term abortion while supporting mothers and policies that advance parental care, birth control, and IVF. IVF, which is in vitro fertilization, unquote. Well, if you read the headlines, you'll see left, right, and center reporting, wow, GOP drops anti-abortion language. How interesting. At a time when the GOP is being criticized for taking away a woman's right to choose. I'm just going to end with the following. I don't know if this is going to endure. I don't know whether 4 years from now, whoever is putting together the GOP platform and whoever is the nominee will go back to the old language. That might happen. I sure hope it doesn't happen. I sure hope that this is a sea change and that one of the great legacies, they haven't always been good legacies, that Donald Trump has left to the GOP is this issue. And it is kind of mixed and kind of ironic because on the one hand, he's going to be seen as and known as from the other side as the guy who got rid of Roe v. Wade and violated women's rights. On the other hand, having done that, he had the fortitude, and if you read the reports, he definitely insisted on this language, that the 2016 language be thrown out. And I'm very glad philosophically that we no longer see the word unborn child. It could be one of his more influential and enduring legacies. And my hope is that the Republican Party becomes, well, if not pro-choice, at least not this anti-life, very, very vicious policy that they've had for so long. And I'm going to stop there.
Great. Thank you. If any of you would like to participate, you can request to speak. We'll bring you up. I've got some questions of my own. I mean, I did a little volunteering for Rudy Giuliani in 2008, and my recollection was that it was the, you know, being kind of nominally pro-choice that cost him the nomination.
Yeah.
And I think to at least some degree, it was like Trump wasn't really anti-abortion in his heart, but he was just the type of guy that's going to, you know, fulfill his promises to the base. And that's what led to these justices. I remember during the 2016 campaign primaries where he had said at one point that maybe women should be punished. And I think he was just taking it to its logical extension. And then, you know, he got some flack for that. And then that may have been what caused the platform to be that way. I think after all the culture wars of 2020 and 2024 that, you know, he now has such command of the party that he's actually able to lead the electorate into being more moderate. Plus some of the people he was running against, like DeSantis, he felt were too anti-abortion and he was trying to run to the center knowing what, you know, he was going to face in the general election.
Well, you're absolutely right. Your memory of all those things, Scott, is very good. And I do recall in 2016, some kind of town hall forum where I cringed because an interviewer on the left, it might have been CNN or something, did press him on the idea of, well, if this is a murder, why don't you prosecute the woman? And Trump fell for the trap and said, yeah, I guess I would. Yeah, I should, not just the doctor. Which is interesting because if he had known the position of the platforms prior to him, they went out of their way to say, even though we're against abortion, we will not penalize the woman. So he didn't even echo. It's an inconsistent position, but he didn't even echo that view. So you're absolutely right. And I think, yes, I think what's happened here is, and again, I'm not praising Trump for being, you know, some principled advocate of individual rights and recognizing the objectivist view, you know, on the metaphysics of protoplasm versus humans. No. However, I think right now he's thinking, I gave you religious anti-abortionists, I gave you three justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, which Bush and Reagan, the two Bushes, and Reagan had for years said they wanted and never gave you, and I gave it to you, and I'm done with you. I'm done with you. It's back to the States. It's not an issue anymore. We're going to shrink this language from, I don't know, 1,000 words or whatever they used in 2016 to these very few words that, more importantly, the words don't include unborn child. I don't know if he knows that philosophically, but whoever wrote it, I'm glad they took that word out at least. It's an embarrassment. And maybe I think that's what's going on. He's basically saying this should not be an issue anymore, which is so interesting because prior to Dobbs versus Jackson, going on the 50th, it wasn't quite the 50th, it was the 40, was it the 49th year? People were starting to think about this as a done deal. In other words, a lost cause, an issue that shouldn't be brought up anymore because it's settled, as they used to say, settled law. And the Supreme Court, especially if it's a conservative court, is the idea of we don't do radical things. We're not judicial activists. And even though we may not like Roe v. Wade, we're not going to overturn it. And yet, then it was overturned. So it kind of shocked the world and shocked the nation and threw the cards on, you know, the 52 cards in the deck up in the air again. But I think that's what's happening. It's not so much, we know actually for years, Trump as a New York Democrat was pretty much pro-choice. I mean, that was fairly obvious if you go back. So he is somewhat of a chameleon. I think he does have some principles about, you know, loving America and loving the Constitution and loving freedom. But he's not the kind of guy who thinks these things through and, yes, wants to get support from those who are, you know, maybe more religious oriented. But this is a huge thing. Anyone, you don't have to read all the platforms I just gave you. All you have to read is 2016 and then 2024. By the way, the reason I skipped over 2024, there wasn't any in 2020, I should say. There wasn't any in 2020 at all. There was COVID, and remember, for both parties, the conventions didn't meet, and there really wasn't any platform. That alone is weird. So the only reason I skipped from 2016 to 2024 is there's nothing in between. But Scott, you mentioned Giuliani. There are other cases of Republicans who were pro-choice and they didn't get far, but it was hard to detect whether they didn't get far because of that position or whether because of other defects they may have had. But I'm just hoping that a whole, that's very now very small wing of the Republican Party that's pro-choice grows.
Well, we also saw Nikki Haley during the debates talk about, you know, advising Republicans to moderate their position.
Yes. And, yes.
You know, with Nancy Mace, I mean, you see it come from women. I don't know if either having pregnancy scares or even, you know, maybe men who've paid for an abortion tend to be a little more pro-choice.
I think one of the best positions they've had in the platform over the years is this idea of no public funding. They're wrong philosophically. I think the other side actually is not giving a good philosophically consistent rights-based argument for women's rights. So Andy Bernstein points this out in his chapter. He's very good. He says, notice how both sides invoke rights. So the other side invokes the rights of women to do what they will with their bodies. And the other side invokes the rights, quote, of unborn children, and they both have a problem. They both are weak in their arguments about what rights are and who they pertain to. They pertain to individuals who are individuated, so they're not, rights don't go to groups of individuals. There's no like black rights or women's rights or capitalist rights, labor's rights, but neither do they go to pieces of individuals. So it's neither parts of individuals nor groupings of individuals that have rights. Only individuals have rights. Anyway, if you can philosophically disentangle all that, you can see that both sides have weak arguments. And Leonard Peikoff's point, I thought was very prescient in 2013, was he said at one point, the right of women to make reproductive choices, he says, is actually at risk because the advocates of a woman's right aren't giving a good argument. And how prescient is that? That is exactly what happened. the Supreme Court, by the way, one of the worst parts of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs, shockingly bad, I think Alito wrote the opinion, said something like, it's not in the Constitution. Now, they're originalists, right? So they're going to say, unless I find the right to abortion in the Constitution, it's not a right. Now, the Air Force also is not in the Constitution. I mean, the Navy is and the Army, right? But, if you had a Supreme Court justice who said the Air Force is unconstitutional because it's not listed in the... It's ridiculous. What is in the Constitution is the government should provide national defense. And a country should be able to grow and develop technology and new whole army, you know, military divisions that are high tech and stuff. The Ninth and Tenth Amendment, for anyone who knows the Constitution, covers the idea of just because we have not enumerated every right in the Bill of Rights from 1 to 7 doesn't mean there are other rights. And that covers abortion. You do not have to name it. The difficulty with the construction of the U.S. Constitution, as the Hamiltonians pointed out, is you do not need a Bill of Rights. Why? Because the document from Article 1 to 6 was a enumerated powers, meaning this is all the government can do and no more. So when the Jeffersonians said, no, we need a First Amendment, talking about a right to speech and a right to religious liberty and assembly and all those things, Hamilton said, quite correctly, the Federalist said, there isn't any enumeration of powers that allows the government to do that. So by implication, they don't have the right to violate your free speech and all these other things. And no, the anti-federalists wanted to make it very explicit. They wanted to write down, as they did, in all the Bill of Rights, the particular rights we have. But they knew they couldn't enumerate them all because there are many. That's why they wrote the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, which, as I said, is a catch-all for, basically says, if we haven't mentioned it, you still have these rights. And that, unfortunately, that problem in the Constitution has been exploited by this current court by saying, I don't see abortion in there, so it doesn't exist as a right.
Great. Well, let's go to our founder, David Kelly. Dr. Kelly, thanks for joining us. You have to unmute yourself. I don't know
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. We can hear you, David.
Okay, great.
Thanks for joining.
Oh, absolutely. This is an issue I've thought about for many years. Richard, I have two questions. But I'll preface it by saying thank you for this review of the Republican platforms over the years, and especially the 2016 one and 2024 one, because, you know, like all the rest of us, I'm faced with a choice between what kind of sounds like two bad choices, Trump and Kamala Harris. But be that as it may, the two points I want to make are, first of all, you mentioned Will Thomas's 2011 article. I worked with him on that. And one of the things that impressed me at the time was that a lot of discussion about abortion and the unborn children and so forth was obviously had a religious background, that, man and woman have sex, they conceive. The embryo already starts out as a human being because why? Not by nature, not by any rational argument, but by God.
Yeah.
So there's a religious element in it. But if you think of it in secular terms, the birth of a human being is a process. It goes through stages.
Yeah.
And somewhere, if you're applying, you know, we can describe that stage, in descriptive physiological terms, fine. But we have to draw moral distinction at some point in a system of rights. In addition to your, summary of the evolution of thought about this over in recent decades, I mean, think back, I think there's a much longer history. in ancient Greece, you know, poor families without contraception had children and that they couldn't support, and they exposed them. They left them on some hill or other, infants, humans, by our standards. And so there's a kind of historical relativity here. We now have the technology to, you know, even for, you know, late birth abortions in many cases, but in any case, for preventing a birth in many different ways, or enhancing or creating a birth through IVF or other means. So there's a kind of relativity here, but you got to draw a line. And line drawing is very difficult in law. And, you know, we're applying a philosophical framework to that based on objectivism, and which I totally agree. And I think the historical aspect, the relativistic aspect of, you're picking a stage in a continuous process of development. I think you and Rand and I draw the line in the right place when someone becomes subject of rights. Anyway, I just want to add that historical perspective. The other thing is, the other point I want to make is, do you think there's an argument for saying that the Dobbs decision was actually proper, not because it was anti-Roe v. Wade, but because it properly returned an issue to the states that the federal government had no business legislating on?
Go ahead.
Now, the counter argument to that is, well, this is an issue of rights. So the federal government, through the 14th Amendment, has to be the ultimate U.S. arbiter of what counts as a right and what doesn't. But, you know, there's something about the federalist structure and the separation of powers between, in particular, in this case, the federal government and the state governments, that part of me thinks, you know, this is actually a good decision, although I disagree with, you know, the abortion advocates completely. But should it, I'm asking, what's your view? Should it be a state issue or a federal issue?
Yeah, in prior discussions of this at TAS and others, I've said it this way: if it's a right, and I think it is, for the would-be mother to choose what to do with their body, then the federalism issue is irrelevant. It's not an issue of what level of government can control it. And Trump actually argues it that way in the bad way. He'll say, well, who can oppose what I did? I put it back to the vote of the people. Well, as we know, David, you know, the majority vote of the people should not determine rights. You could throw the First Amendment back that way and say, well, let's take a vote on whether we have free speech or not. So the first cut of the deck, so to speak, has to be, is it a right or not? If it's a right, then you can't vote it away. And it's improper to vote it away. Now, the problem with Roe v. Wade is you have a court in 1973 concocting not an illegitimate biological distinction of the trimesters, but they did introduce the trimester idea. And the idea is very weird, but it kind of fits your analysis. But the trimester idea was, well, a woman really, really has rights in the first 3 months. And the second 3 months, it starts withering away. It starts becoming diluted. And then in the final trimester, this is the whole late-term abortion or partial abortion debate, the state intervenes. The state can intervene. The state can come in. And I find there's a problem with that objectively. One of the things, both metaphysically and philosophically and even politically, that attracts me to the idea that birth creates a human is it's so goddamn objective. I mean, I think it's way more objective than things like conception And, you know, what's the difference between a zygote and an embryo and a fetus? And, you know, it's different for different women. It's different for different times. And even science can detect, you know, heartbeats at this point or that point. It becomes arbitrary. But there's nothing more fixed than the idea of it's outside of me now. It's not a part of me now. There's an umbilical cord being cut. There's if individuation is a thing, and that's what makes a person, I can then that should be the standard. And of course, if you go all the way back, David, you know that Aristotle has helped us with the idea of the potential versus the actual. So if an acorn is a potential oak tree, it is, but an acorn is not an oak tree. They're not a is not a, and a fetus is a potential human, but not a human. And that's the whole question, right? That the woman has the right to choose whether she shall make it into a human or not. And I think all those things are relevant, but I like your idea that once you realize that it's a process, that not intervening, certain things will happen. Kind of makes it harder to judge, makes it a little more difficult to judge. I, David, I wonder what your view is on, I'm looking here from Ayn Rand in 1975, one of the last Ayn Rand letters.
Uh-huh.
She says, well, listen to this now, because Leonard echoes this in 2013. She says, quote, never, this is after Roe v. Wade, of course, it's 2 years after Roe v. Wade, and she never directly commented on Roe v. Wade, which I think is interesting. But in 1975, she says, never mind the vicious nonsense of claiming that an embryo has a right to life. A piece of protoplasm has no rights and no life in the human sense of the term. Now, here's the key phrase. One may argue about the later stages of a pregnancy, but the essential issue concerns only the first 3 months.
Yeah.
Unquote. Now, that's, wow, that's interesting. And then Leonard in 2013, in the essay called Abortion Rights or Pro-Life, he says, quote, the status of the embryo in the first trimester is the basic issue that can't be sidestepped. The embryo is clearly pre-human, and only mystical notions of religious dogma treat this lump of cells as constituting a person. Now, I'm skipping down here. An embryo is a potential human being. It can, granted the woman's choice, develop into an infant. But what it actually is during the first trimester is a mass of relatively undifferentiated cells that exist as part of a woman's body. We must acknowledge, here's the key, we must acknowledge that the embryo under 3 months is something far more primitive than a frog or a fish, unquote. This language is very interesting because the whole time you're asking, okay, what about after 3 months? Is Ayn and Leonard actually saying there's something to the argument that the second trimester and the third trimester, we're getting closer to human and maybe it's a taking. They don't say that, David, but their focus on the first trimester, I think, is very interesting and rarely brought up by objectivists.
Yeah, there's something about her alluding to it being immoral in the third trimester, even if she wouldn't want a law against it.
Yeah, the immoral versus the illegal. Yeah,
but
I've often put it as something like this: that it should not be illegal to abort right up until the end, but in the self interest of the would be mother says, don't do that. It's ridiculous. It's dangerous to your health. Everybody, doctors do concede this, that late term abortions are dangerous physically. Yeah. But I think they're also, this will sound weird, but I think they're also psychologically dangerous, harmful. I think it's wrong because everyone knows what happens over time, right? I think it's really harmful for a woman to wait. I understand why she might wait. Other things are happening in her life, right? But they will report. They feel terrible aborting, you know, at 8 months. But the issue here is not, is she murdering some human being? No, she's not. But I want to revert to the self-interested angle of, I want the woman to be self-interested. And there are so many ways to have birth control and prophylactics that this is like one of the most ridiculous and irrational and unsafe and psychologically harmful way to do it. But a quote religious person listening to me would say, you're monstrous because you're still only focusing on the egoism of the woman. See what I mean, David?
Yeah, I do. But I also want to say, add another point here, which is, you know, a child is born. Okay, we now have an infant. But the whole philosophy of rights is really articulated in Rand's theory and most other theories of rights in terms of a mature adult, the ability to reason, the right to choose, value of achievement. An infant has none of these things. It cannot reason, it cannot support itself, it cannot produce. Right. It's totally at the mercy of its parents. And so, in what sense, at best, you could argue that an infant once born has the right to life. But I don't know any parents who would say, oh, if a child, you know, wants to get language after 2 or 3 years, wants to do something, and the parent thinks that, you know, that's going to harm you, the parent will say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
That's not the way adult rights work. And so even rights have a gradualist, sequential time relevant application to human beings, even after birth. So
David, what do you make of the legal, not really moral, but legal distinction between minor and major, where the line is usually drawn at what, 18 years? But so it sounds like a bright line, and that actually is very helpful, you know, in many probate courts and child custody, the things like that. Even today's disputes about gender, whether you can inform the parents or not. But even 18 years, David, you might say, well, lifespans have expanded from, 40 years to 80 years. So why is so that's changed, right? That's what you mean by the relativist aspect of it. So why is 18 still a bright line? Why isn't it 17? Why isn't it 16? Why isn't it, or maybe it goes the other way. I don't know. If life is becoming longer, why hasn't that legal standard of 18 change to 19 or 20 or 21? Have you thought about that? Remember, it comes up with things like the draft and whether you can drink and whether you can drive. There's a bunch of things surrounding the 18-year line.
Oh, it comes up with gender transformation.
Yeah.
That's the most recent thing and the hottest debated. There are, so we're talking about another legal line. The law has to protect rights, and that, first of all, it has to define them in order to do that. So it's got to draw lines at infancy. This is a human being, right to life, but not yet a right to, opinion or freedom of owning. Think of a child claiming, okay, this is my toy. It's my property. Well, they don't really have property rights.
Right.
But, and then it has to say when a human being has developed to the point where they no longer have to, in a sense, the 18-year-old issue is mostly, you no longer have to listen to your parents. You're no longer under the control. You can make your own decisions.
Right, right.
Right. Not there's just about drinking and driving, but
there's even a one of the things I love about the language of the law in probate. There's even a language that speaks of the age of emancipation. When I was going through a divorce, someone used that phrase and they said, well, your kid won't reach the age of emancipation until X. And I said, what? I never heard that before. What are you talking about? Because it sounds like, what, he's a slave until he's emancipated? And no, yeah. It's a legal decision. But it's also related to this topic, isn't it, David? Because the minor, in legal terms at least, but maybe morally as well, is still under the control of the major, of the parent.
Right.
And it hasn't, quote unquote, been emancipated yet. And that is similar to the argument of, hey, I am the would-be mother. This fetus is inside me. I'm controlling or not what to do with you. And you could say the same thing about a 14-year-old. Now, this is not... this
child
is, this
rights
is actually
could be a whole separate topic.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is they're all connected, and it's a really important issue. And I'll just end here. I think objectivism as a philosophy could use a lot more development on this score. And
yeah, agreed.
We've worked on that with Will Thomas and others, the Atlas Society, and Richard. Yeah. But I'll just end by saying, Richard, what you've talked to us about tonight is really, really interesting. Politically. So thank you.
Yes. Thank you, David.
Great topic. Thanks to everyone for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Thank you so much, Richard, for doing this. It was a great conversation.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, David. Thanks, everyone.